It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Sandy Rios with you on this 4th of July weekend special, in which we're going to introduce to you two heroes. America still has heroes. Recently, on the 72nd anniversary of D-Day, we had a surprise caller, and you're going to hear him in just a second. And then earlier in the week, we talked to a hero who still lives on, who's speaking out about the dangers of radical Islam from a position of great knowledge, lay his life on the line to say what he's going to say. So stay tuned, sit back. First of all, this surprise caller on the 72nd anniversary of D-Day. Let's listen. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
How you doing?
I'm good. How old are you, Joseph?
I'm 91.
Wow. All right, so you served in World War II, correct?
You're cutting out on me. What did I do? What, ma'am?
Did you serve in World War II?
Yes, I served with General George S. Patton, the Third Army. I landed the 6th of June, 44 on an Normandy beachhead, Utah beachhead.
Wow. So, Joseph, you're one of the survivors.
Yeah, there's not many of us left.
Tell us. You were 16 then?
Yes.
So tell us about that day.
Well, as a young boy, I saw a lot of carnage. I'd never seen that many ships in my life. I never seen so much carnage in my life. But I volunteered to get in, and you know what? When my mom and daddy signed for me, I got in a mess. I said, Lord, I'm in a mess over here. But I got through it. I got through it. Thank goodness the man above the clouds found favor with me.
So, Joseph, can you describe being on that boat, coming up to that beach? What did you see? What did you experience?
Well, we was watching the first wave went in. They got knocked out, and the second wave got knocked out. The third wave, just a handful of the third wave got in. They called for the fourth wave, and then some of the fourth wave got in, but not all of them. And then they called for the fifth wave. I was in the fifth wave. And so we got in.
And so you mean, and you, when you got off those boats, you were right in the water. You had to walk in the water, did you not, in order to get to the beach?
Well, I was holding my M1 rifle over my head, and I was in water up to my chest.
Wow. And as you were walking, my understanding is that there were bodies on all in the water, bodies on the beach. This is
all
what
the bodies you, all over the water was from red.
And so, Joseph, in a moment like that, does a man pray or you just keep moving? What goes on in your mind?
Well, you know what went on through my mind? I couldn't believe that Hitler had done what he'd done. I had the blessing to go with General Patton to rescue that Dachau, that terrible prison camp.
Yes.
Sweetheart, and carnage up there, you can't believe what happened there. My goodness alive. I couldn't believe that a man supposed to be a son of God could do a terrible thing there like Hitler did.
You know, Joseph, my father was in the Third Army under Patton also, and he was part of the group that came to Dachau. Isn't that interesting? My own father was in the same division with you. So when you got to Dachau, what did you have any idea at all about what you would see?
Well, when we got to Dachau, see, we went behind the enemy lines at night. And when we got to Dachau that morning, the CIA guy rolled out a map on the Jeep. And he said, here's Dachau and here's the guards. He said, I don't know what we're going to do if they want to surrender. Well, when they seen us, they jumped out of those towers and went through the woods like a deer. I could see that some of them were wearing number 10 soles, some 11 shoes. They went through the woods and never turned back. They're still running, I guess. We never did see them.
And so what happened next?
That was the guards.
And what happened next?
Well, I was, at the time being, I was driving for Colonel Smith. He was an aide to General Patton. And he wanted me to take some TNT and put down by the side of that incinerator and blow it up. And he said, I want you to put three or four sticks in there. Well, when I got to the ordnance depot, they gave me a whole case. They said they didn't break the case. So I just took the whole case and put down there. And I told the boy, don't put your trip wire on there till I get away from here. I dug down and put as much down there as I could. And when I said fire in a hole, he pushed that trip wire. And that thing, when it blowed up, it went from here to the moon. It looked silver. And I never did see it fall. I don't know where it went.
This was
went to the moon.
Joseph, this was the incinerator where they burned the Jews?
Sweetheart, can you turn your volume up just a little?
Is this the incinerator where they burned the bodies?
Oh, lady, you ain't never seen such a mess in your life since you've been living. We got there, there was two rail cars outside, flat cars. They had bodies stacked on each side like cordwood, 8 foot tall on each side of those two rail cars. It was fixed and taken to the landfill, but we got there before they did it.
Joseph, when you came into Dachau, did you, let me see if I can ask this clearly, your fright, your experience invading Normandy, landing on the beach, putting your life at risk, did you feel when you came into Dachau that it was worth what you had done?
Oh, yes, yes. I'd do it again 100,000 times again. Yeah.
Anything else you want to tell us about your experience?
Well, I had the pleasure of serving with General George S. Patton. He is the greatest general ever walked this earth. You know that, don't you?
I know he was a great general.
When all the wind up of this thing is over with, history will report and will reveal that George Patton saved the world. I was with that man from Normandy all the way to Berlin.
Wow. Joseph, do your children know your story?
Mama, can you turn this phone number up a little bit for me?
No, I don't know how.
Joseph?
Let me see if I can turn my phone up just a little bit.
All right.
Well, he's got a volume on here somewhere.
Joseph? If you just tuned in, we're listening.
I tried to turn my volume up, but I can't find it.
Oh, can you hear me? If I talk like this, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you a little better. You know, when you're 91 years old, you're half deaf anyway.
Joseph, do your children know your story?
Well, sweetheart, we just wrote a book. 14 of us World War II veterans got together and wrote a book, and it's on Amazon.
What's the name of it?
Hold just a minute. No, you're going to ask me that just a minute. Get me a World War II book by selling that in that bag, would you?
If you just tuned in, this is Joseph, and he was...
I'll give you everything you need. Just hold it.
All right. I'm just telling people who you are. Joseph was 16 years old when he landed on Omaha Beach. He served with General George Patton in the Third Army. And this is a one-in-a-million phone call. One-in-a-million. Joseph, you are a jewel. I'm so glad you called. I'm so honored.
Well, sweetheart, I'd do it again. This is the greatest country in the world, but our country's in a mess right now.
Yep.
Our country's in a mess.
Yes, sir. Yes, it is. And that I think it's like your children. My dad was your age. It is our responsibility not to let the truth die. Our kids don't know what happened in public schools. Our grandchildren, it's our responsibility to teach them. Do you have the name of your book yet?
Yeah, Mama's going to have to hold just a minute.
Okay.
Mama's in that bag back there, in the bag by the desk.
It's on Amazon.
You find it. It's in about...
I found it, Daddy.
Okay. Hold just a minute.
Okay.
This right here.
All right, good.
Okay, now 14 of us World War II veterans got together, and we wrote this book. It says The Last Eyewitness of World War II Memories from D-Day to 70th Anniversary. It was wrote by John Long and Walter Parks.
Wonderful. All right, Joseph, we're going to put that on our Facebook page, and you can bet that I'm going to be getting that book. Joseph, let me ask you, as you look back on this in terms of your relationship with God, did you feel that God did spare you on that day? And how is your relationship with him now?
Well, sweetheart, I belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and my father was an elder, and he gave me a priesthood blessing. If I would listen to my commanders and do what I was supposed to, I'd have the blessing to return. When I got on that beachhead and saw all that carnage, I said, Heavenly Father, that blessing needs to work. And it did. It did.
And you're in Mississippi now. You're spending you and your wife are both still alive together, right?
Yes. We're both 91, and we're fixing to celebrate our 70th wedding anniversary, the 9th of August.
How about kids? You have kids?
Oh, yeah, I've got three children. Got a boy and two girls. But my boy passed away, but my two girls are still living. I took my two daughters up on the honor flight to Washington just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, those are wonderful. Are they not wonderful, those honor flights? If people haven't heard about them, if you still have a World War II vet in your family, in your life, you need to Google honor flights and take them on these flights while you still can, because they are tremendous. Well, Joseph...
all the veterans need to go up there and see the World War II monument. It sure is beautiful.
It really is. It is a beautiful tribute to the men and women who served in World War II.
Thank you. Thank you, sweetheart. It's been an honor.
All right. Well, it's been an honor for us too, sir. Sandy Rios back with you with our 4th of July weekend special. And coming up next, another of America's heroes, a contemporary hero. But first, just last week, Attorney General Loretta Lynch said this.
We'll be releasing that partial transcript tomorrow. Well, what we're not going to do is further proclaim this individual's pledges of allegiance to terrorist groups and further his propaganda. We are trying not to re-victimize those who went through that horror. The reason why we're going to limit these transcripts is to avoid re-victimizing those who went through this horror. It's our goal to be as transparent as possible in this investigation.
Sandy Rios with you. Of course, that's the Attorney General. Over the weekend, that's a compilation of her Sunday shows in which she explained why they're going to take out those little nasty passages about Islam and Omar Mateen's allegiance to various Islamic groups. I think it's really interesting. Bill Otis from the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation wrote an article called called Obama's Ministry of Information, of course, borrowing a term that's used for totalitarian states. And in the midst of it, he says, how many thousands of times have we been told by criminal justice reformers that we should rely on data-driven policy and evidence-based determination, and that troglodytes instead rely on nativist emotion? Largely, the insistence on data and evidence, which sounds unarguable to the abstract, is simply a dodge, a tactic of delay and evasion to make us doubt what we've been learning from one source after the next for months. For example, that the police have become cautious to the point of danger, or that the spike in murder is a nationwide problem. Sometimes, though, the insistence of data simply means an insistence on scrubbed data. Evidence adverse to the political agenda du jour, in Obama's case, whitewashing jihad, literally gets blotted out. Hence this story from, and then he has marked out, but you can read it, Minister of Information, and then the words back in regular print, Attorney General. So you have to let that soak in. She's calling her the Minister of Information, which again would be her title in a totalitarian state. My next guest was very active, and still is, in public service. When the scrubbing of all of the information for the training for our national security experts began, and I want to start, I don't usually do this, but I want to read more of his bio than I normally do because I think it will help you understand where he's coming from and why it is he knows what he's talking about. Rich Higgins is the Vice President of Intelligence and National Security for RED. It's a company that develops, tests, and evaluates new combat capabilities for special ops, intelligence, and irregular warfare missions. He's an expert on the nexus between theological doctrines and information age unconventional warfare. 20 years he spent combating terrorism. He managed, in 2004, he formed the Department of Defense, DOD's Irregular Warfare Support Program Office, and served as their first program manager until June of 2010. He's advised the White House, Congress, foreign governments on strategy, technology, and terrorism-related matters. He's currently a Lincoln Fellow with the Claremont Institute. He's an Army veteran. He has a master's degree in strategic security from the National War College. And I wanted you to know all of that. And last night, Rich was on with Sean Hannity, and he's a new acquaintance to me, and I wanted to introduce him thoroughly to you this morning. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Sandy. It's great to join you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I thought you needed more time last night, so I'm glad that you and I have a little bit here. Were you surprised by the quick reversal by the Justice Department and the FBI on releasing the information, the transcripts?
I think the reversal was a decision made based upon the fact that for the first time they saw the public, Congress, even members of their own party starting to question what's going on here. One of the points I made on Hannity's show last night was that both Phil and I, who were on that panel together, for your audience who got to see it.
Yeah, Phil Haney, good friend, yes.
Right. We've lived this for years. They expect us, using the redacted version of that memo, they expect us to formulate national security strategy, to develop training programs. And that memo, with all of the references to Islam omitted, is basically the state of the intelligence community right now as it comes to understanding the threat. That's why the FBI can go and meet with Omar Mateen three times and is unable to discern where he is on the spectrum of jihad.
So the point you're making is a very good one. It's a very graphic illustration. The way they scrubbed the information in these phone calls between Mateen and police is the way they have scrubbed manuals of training. But before we get into the specifics of that, Rich, I'm just curious, what were you doing on 9/11 in 2001?
I was actually, at the time, I had recently left the Army and was working standing up the first research and development program for bomb squads, working with the Department of Justice. And I was actually sent to New York immediately following it. So I was in New York on September 12th, and I worked on the pilot there for a couple of weeks.
You know, it's funny. My husband, who was a former FBI, and I were just talking. We lived, we met actually in a building here in D.C. It was a brand new building. I was, I had just come to D.C. right after 9/11, and he was working on the Osama bin Laden terrorism unit. And in the building that we lived, it was all military and national. The energy level here in D.C. during that time was amazing. But the thing I remember, Rich, I have to say personally, I didn't, you know, the whole business of 9/11 and terrorism and understanding jihad and Islam was way out of the realm of my understanding. Where was your understanding at that point of this whole situation?
At the time, I think I was more of a tactician. I had been in the military as an explosive ordnance disposal specialist, basically working on bomb squads, for those of you who've seen the movie Hurt Locker. And getting out of the military, I used my technical background with a mechanical engineering undergraduate to start working in that field. I would say I really got into the Islam aspects of it. I had a friend of mine named Pani, who's actually a Canadian citizen, but he was a Coptic Christian from Egypt, that after the towers fell down, he sent me a box, and it had 13 books inside of it. And I started going through those books, and what he was trying to do for me, although I didn't realize at the time, was begin to paint the picture of what we were actually dealing with. And I would say over the next 5 or 6 years, I began to be basically a student, self-taught, beginning to learn how the enemy sees himself. And I think that's really the biggest thing that we need to understand is that it's a tenet of warfare, right? How the enemy understands himself, it allows us to do his most likely courses of action, his most dangerous courses of action, the end state he seeks to achieve, and even more important than that, how he defines his own defeat. So the question is, how does the Islamic movement, for example, within the Islamic movement, ISIS, how does ISIS define their own defeat? And then our strategy should be to give them that in spades.
You know, it's interesting to me, while you're learning, you get these books and you're training, the counter story to that is that in the Bush White House, a parade of Muslim Brotherhood operatives began to be displayed, and President Bush started telling us how peaceful Islam is. And now we know that's just talking points from the Muslim Brotherhood. And the White House and the executive branch was being co-opted, and the message even then. I guess the question is, and this is maybe this is not what you would want to answer, but if you guys could research and come to an understanding, if the Holy Land Foundation trial in 2008 didn't bring understanding, then what was the breakdown at the White House that nobody seemed to get the message to the president that he was being used by the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think there's a general reluctance to be the truth bearer, if you will. I think a big part of it was Americans are naturally, we naturally want to believe there's good in everything, right? And so that you have a convergence of the subversive activities, the active influence efforts by elements of the Muslim Brotherhood and similar organizations, and then its convergence with the postmodernist narrative that already existed here culturally. In other words, the Muslim Brotherhood, as early as the 1940s, if you're talking about some of the earlier authors like Said Qutb, in the 1940s America, Said Qutb assessed as being spiritually vulnerable. So if 1940s America was spiritually vulnerable, what are we today? And it's really important to understand that to jihadis and to these Islamists, this is a spiritual war for them. They define jihad as spiritual warfare. It's really the essence of the battle. It's not simply the bombs and the guns. It's about the destruction of your faith.
Well, and could we say that word, the jihad, is one of the words scrubbed so that people in intelligence agencies don't have even the ability to understand what it actually means? I think they've boiled it down to maybe struggle, but I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. So you are equipping yourself. you're studying, Rich, and you're becoming an expert, at least as much as you can, on all these books. And I'm sure you're bringing this then to your the work that you are doing. At what point then, personally, did you see everything start going south? Oh, this first indication that, oh, no, we can't talk about that. How did that happen?
I can give you a bit of a timeline that will paint a picture for your audience. And I think it's important they understand that this is happening outside of official channels. So the Bush administration, my read on it from my point in the in the apparatus was the Bush administration didn't go there because, like you said, they had bought off on Islam as a religion. Peace, we can't go there. There were people in the system who knew otherwise, but could not get the bureaucracy to move in that direction because, effectively, that statement by the president, it put Islam off limits for understanding the threat doctrine. I was actually, and this is in the middle of the war in Iraq, so I would say it was late 2005. I got a phone call from an FBI agent who had never met before. He said, I need you to come to a meeting tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock in Virginia. And I said, am I getting arrested or something? And he said, no, this is a meeting I need you to come to. And when I showed up at this literally a warehouse in Virginia, there were probably 40 other people from across the U.S. national security apparatus, intelligence community, FBI, DOD, the Marine Corps, a few others. And we spent that morning, because all of us had individually been identified by this FBI agent as working on this problem set, but of our, of our own motivation. And so we created a little network that began to dig a little bit deeper into this. I went back to my position at the time at the Pentagon and continued to run my program office. And I was driving to work one day in 2007, literally sitting on Route 66 traffic, and my phone rings, and it's, we hold for a call from the office of the vice president. Okay. And the vice president's national security advisor came on, Samantha Radvich, and she asked me, hey, there's an intelligence analyst that's working up on the J-2, and he's been asked to leave. I guess he's made some people angry. And this is the story, and I don't know if your audience is familiar with it, of Steve Coughlin.
Well, they know. Steve, he's been on the show, but you can always, every time you have a different audience on radio, so tell the story. Okay. Yeah.
So Steve Coughlin was the Islamic advisor, probably the most knowledgeable expert in the United States on the theological doctrines associated with jihad and warfare and Islam. And he was working for Admiral Dorsett, and he was effectively pushed out by a gentleman named Hisham Islam, who worked for the Deputy Secretary of Defense, but who has a very questionable background, shall we say, and lots of Muslim Brotherhood potential affiliations. And so when Steve was asked to leave, we ended up contracting him at the request of the vice president's office. And this is really where it started to get more interesting, because at that point, my office and my programs became illuminated to the political apparatus of the Muslim Brotherhood here, and the amount of political pressure on us began to significantly increase. And
hold on just one second. I want to interrupt you just a second, because 2007 was at the end of the Bush administration. So this started when President Bush was still in office.
Correct.
And the Muslim Brotherhood already had operatives in the I know this, but I want to underscore this, because I think this is important to our understanding.
But when it comes to this enemy, both parties are wrong. On the Bush administration, I've said this before, the Muslim Brotherhood was at and influencing the meetings. During the Obama administration, the policies being set at the meetings were the Brotherhood's policies. It seemed like they were running the meetings. So in 2006, we saw the shift. Steve gets pushed out. He's working for me. We all come under attack. Obama comes into office, and investigations just come rolling in on us left and right. I end up at the War College. While I'm on staff at the War College, first as a student, but then I stayed on there for years as a professor. Muslim Brotherhood operatives are all over the place there. They are setting the National War College curriculum against Islam. They are setting the way our future general officers think about and contextualize this threat. It was probably the most alarming thing I saw. And then I ended up in 2011 going to work for Special Operations Command on a classified project for Admiral McRaven. And in that time frame, I think, is where you saw that where the PC meter had begun ticking up in 2006. In 2011, it really pegged, because now we saw with a series of actions that seemed to be coordinated between the hard ultra-left and the Muslim Brotherhood, a specific program was put in place to purge all Islamic training material, all fact-based Islamic training material, from the national security training apparatus.
Rich, we have to take a break, so this is a good place to do that. Rich Higgins is my guest. Again, he's the Vice President of Intelligence and National Security for REO, and lots of experience in this whole thing, and we're not finished talking about it. And so I'm so glad that you're with us, Rich. We want to hear the rest of it, and we don't want to hurry this through. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. Sandy Rios back with you. Who doesn't love the Stars and Stripes Forever? Just reminding you on this 4th of July weekend that America still has heroes. And one of them is our guest today, Rich Higgins. And we're going to continue our discussion with him. But first, just listen. A little reminder of what the President of the United States has said about Islam.
Our enemies respect no religious freedom. Al-Qaeda's cause is not Islam. It's a gross distortion of Islam.
The future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam.
ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim.
We have reaffirmed again and again that the United States is not and never will be at war with Islam. Islam teaches peace.
That courtesy of Sean Hannity's program last night, that montage of the statements of the President of the United States in regard to Islam, misleading statements, I might add. We talked briefly about how President Bush came right out of 9/11 saying Islam is a peaceful religion, which caused a muting in the ability of security forces and intelligence services to really get to the bottom of what that attack was all about. Let me also say that the whole notion, when the president said the future does not belong to those who, slander the prophet? That was odd to our ears. He said that at the United Nations. And, of course, that is all part of this UN Resolution 1618 that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are in full support of, which is an international movement to silence any criticism of Islam. So you just have to know, Mrs. Clinton is on record saying that because of our First Amendment rights, we will have to use in this country the old-fashioned methods, she says, of peer pressure and shaming. This is the candidate for president of the United States, and so it is likely to get only worse if we don't do something about it. My guest is Rich Higgins, and against Rich is a national security expert to the nines, and he was... present and accounted for during the shift in all of this training. And before we took the break, Rich, you were telling us about what led up to the scrubbing of the manuals and how the Muslim Brotherhood had a seat at the table with the Bush administration. But during the Obama administration, they were suddenly started guiding and actually writing the curricula. What did that look like? And was there a certain day or timeline upon which this happened?
I think we can go to September of 2011. And again, pay attention to how quickly this timeline rolls out, because this really was the inflection point in the war. On September 23rd of 2011, Spencer Ackerman, hardcore left-wing member of, if everybody remembers, the journalist, gaggle of left-wing journalists that were, synchronizing their messaging and coordinating things in the 2000 presidential election. And Ackerman is one of his most famous quotes is, find a right-winger's blank and smash it through a plate glass window, take a snapshot of the bleeding mess and send it out in a Christmas card to let the right know that it needs to live in a constant state of fear.
Wow.
So he writes that on it's one of his blog posts. But Ackerman writes an article targeting on September 23rd, 2011, FBI training as it relates to Islam, saying that, you know, basically the FBI is a bunch of Islamophobes. They're looking at authors and content and doctrines that they don't need to be looking at. He sends a follow-on article on October 5th, 2011, where he then expands his attack to the FBI and the Department of Defense. On October 17th of 2011, so 12 days later, Muslim Advocate, MB-affiliated group, writes to John Brennan, then the National Security Advisor for Combating Terrorism and Homeland Security. And on October 5th, 2011, we see a joint staff action memo tasking the Department of Defense to review all their training material and trainers to make sure, you know, we're not doing anything, quote-unquote, Islamophobic. But the most interesting thing about that joint staff action memo, which was initially pushed forward by the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense and tasked by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff out to all the services. So this is Department of Defense-wide review. But they're looking at the three targets are intelligence, information operations, and psychological operations. And if you're fighting an ideological movement, those are the three most important parts, right? With the intelligence aspect of that being absolutely critical, because if you can't understand the enemy as the enemy understands himself, how do you even begin to fight him? And that's how we end up where we are with the mess we have in the Middle East today. So to consummate the action on November 3rd, 2011, Brennan writes a letter back to Muslim Advocates saying that the review, and I'll call it the purge, is underway, replacing that fact-based training with what we hear now is this countering violent extremism narrative, which, you know, basically means nothing. As a matter of fact, the countering violent extremist narrative was authored by several Muslim brothers. And of course, you know, the number one thing they identify in there is returning veterans and Christian groups as, you know, the number one threat in the United States. It really is just amazing. So,
Rich, let me interrupt you, because I mean the narrative is fabulous. I want to drive something home, because we talked about countering violent extremism, especially last week, because it, you know, the funding for it came up in the House, and the leadership, Paul Ryan and Mr. Mike McConnell. I'm just blanking. Not McConnell. Michael McCaul, the chairman of the Department of the Committee on Homeland Security in the House, both pushed for funding for countering violent extremism. Mm-hmm. Do you have any explanation? I do, but I want to know, do you have any explanation for that?
The explanation is, like I said, both parties are working with MB operatives.
I mean, Muslim Brotherhood.
Right, the Muslim Brotherhood amount of influence over our political appointees in the United States is mind-boggling. And the reason they have it is the amount of money that flows from sovereign wealth funds and PACs and foreign donors onto Capitol Hill is simply mind-boggling. We know inside the community that when we touch the political level of the government, so what I say is the professional bureaucrats who work national security know when they reach the political level of government that we have to approach that politician with the assumption that the Muslim Brotherhood has already co-opted them.
Let me just go back to your timeline, because the head of national security, John Brennan, issues this letter. And by the way, it has been noted that that letter came out so quickly, so, you know, asking for a review or a purge of all the training manuals. I hesitate to mention this, but I'm going to, and you can plead the fifth. I have been told that it's possible that John Brennan converted to Islam when he was in Saudi Arabia. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about it. I've heard the same rumor. No way to substantiate it one way or the other.
Whatever the case, he certainly was the key person who ordered this purging. And you know what doesn't make sense to me, Rich? Why is it then that last week, this is just makes no sense. The John Brennan was the one that contradicted the president's characterization of ISIS as diminishing, getting smaller, dwindling, their power, losing their power. And he comes out with a statement saying, no, they're not, and they're coming here. I don't understand. Does he think he's having a second thoughts about what he's done?
I think he is trying to position himself as somebody that, because of his current position as CIA director, he's trying to position himself as somebody who stays over when the new administration comes in. And I think that would be a catastrophic mistake if the Republicans do take the presidency.
Yeah. All right. I want, it's not like we can't figure this out, Rich, but I'd like to have you spell out for us, if you could, why this purging, this use of words? Because the president told us, you know, last week, what difference of words? If I didn't say, you know, Islamic terrorism, you think this is going to change anything? And you maintain that this is actually lethal. Explain to us why.
Well, I think when you're running a giant bureaucracy, I mean, there's a very carefully constructed, deliberate decision-making process, and particularly in the intelligence side. What this process does is it drives everything from policy to, you know, your tactical rules of engagement. And so what we've seen is the inability to understand the enemy as he understands himself collapses our ability to understand their objective. So for starters, their objective isn't killing as many Americans as possible. We're going to kill all Americans. Those are political talking points. They're the enemy's real objectives in this war, whether you're talking about the subversive aspects of the Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations like that, or you're talking about the fighter organizations like Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb and Al-Nusra, their objectives are political. The means they go about achieving those are different, but they work together, as does the left, oftentimes in unison with those subversive actors. So it's really important that we understand that by collapsing that ability to do strategic level intelligence, we're now formulating policies, programs, spending money. And an analogy I use often is 15 years into the Cold War, we had thousands of experts on Marxism, communism, socialism, Russian linguists. And today, in this war, how many experts do you have on Islam? You know, it sounds like you've had 3 of the 10 of them on your show. I mean, I'm not overstating that.
No, I know. I know.
All right. Okay. So people who understand, and then the consequences we see on TV is we have generals come on TV and say, we don't have a strategy. 15 years into a war, we have general officers saying we don't have a strategy. I mean, it's simply mind-boggling.
You know, Rich, the other thing, too, like the FBI director showed his own ignorance when he couldn't understand why the Orlando shooter was pledging allegiance or mentioning his support for 3 different Islamic groups. How can that be? They're in it. He didn't even himself understand that the ideology at the very core of it was the same for all 3 groups.
Right, but when you define the threat, it's not even simply ideology. You have to get into the core theological doctrines of warfare inside Islam. And we need to remember that this ban, which, you know, does everything from prevent, you know, we can't identify friend from foe at the tactical level in Afghanistan with the green on blue attacks, but at the strategic level, what that ban does is it creates a dependency for us on the Muslim Brotherhood. And that state of dependency on the Brotherhood is exactly what they want. They then take control of the deliberate decision-making process. When the general has a question, he doesn't have an American he can ask about what's going on, what's transpiring, what that cleric just said, is it radical or not? He has to ask a Muslim brother. And a case in point is in response to the Orlando attack, I was up early that day. My daughter was up very early that morning. And I mean, by 7 o'clock in the morning, you had an imam from a Muslim Brotherhood affiliated mosque who we have in open statements making all sorts of pejoratives in the past. The guy is obviously a bad actor. He's on TV with the mayor of Orlando, with the police chief. So, what a Muslim who's not aligned with the movement living in Orlando sees is this Muslim Brotherhood guy is the authority in Orlando when it comes to the Islamic community there. Right? It would be like having a mafia don on TV with the mayor and wondering why Italians weren't turning in the mafia. Mm. It's insane.
And it is, in San Bernardino, the same thing happened. You know, the CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, gave a press conference before even the police did. And right. and you also, Rich, we're going to be out of time here, but you also make the point that we actually did the bidding of the Muslim Brotherhood, accomplished their goals for them through the Arab Spring. We acted as their instrument. We actually fulfilled some of their strategic objectives. I want to ask you, go ahead.
If you could go back to September 9th, 2001, before they killed Ahmad Massoud, when the attack really began, with the towers coming down 2 years later, and you could tell them, in 15 years, the United States will be $20 trillion in debt. Iraq will be an Islamic Republic under Sharia law. Saddam will be dead. Afghanistan will be an Islamic Republic under Sharia law. Pakistan will still have nuclear weapons. Iran will be moving hard right with $150 billion the United States gives back to them. Erdogan will be taking Turkey towards the Muslim Brotherhood. Syria would be moving millions. The conflict in Syria would be the source of area. Millions of Muslim immigrants.
Nobody would believe it. Nobody would believe it. The clock is going
to
end.
Sandy.
Rich, you and I have to talk again. This has been fabulous. And in order to equip yourselves, counterjihad.com. counterjihad.com. Equip yourselves. I think we're going to have to protect ourselves and make sure we get the truth out in spite of our elected officials. Rich Higgins, thank you for your service and for your wisdom today. Sandy Rios in the morning.